Good afternoon, and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week we learn about Axis Dance from artistic director and co-founder Judy Smith, who will be joined by choreographer Linda Johnson. Details of this Saturday's 7th annual Switchboard Music Festival are shared by one of the co-directors of the festival, Annie Phillips, who brought with her some of the folks you're hearing right now live, providing our introductory music to Open Air, the Mobius Guitar Trio, who are part of the 8-hour lineup of musicians at the Brava Theater, headlined by the Kronos Quartet. Conductor Martin Segelka returns to talk about the San Francisco Wind Ensemble's last concert of the season, also happening this Saturday. And Peter Robinson helps us celebrate Shakespeare's birthday, including a preview of this year's Oregon Shakespeare Festival and a remembrance of Peter Matheson. Stay tuned. Excerpt from Study for Mobius by Samuel Adams, performed by Mobius, who are Robert Nance, Mason Fish, and Matthew Holmes Linder. More live music with the guitar trio in the hour ahead. This weekend, the Axis Dance Company presents its 2014 home season at the Malanga Casklord Center for the Arts in Oakland. I'm joined today by Judy Smith, artistic director and co-founder of Axis, and Linda Johnson, choreographer and performer. Judith Smith is artistic director, founding member of the Axis Dance Company. Prior to a disabling car accident at age 17, Judith was a champion equestrian and continues her passion for horses by helping to rescue and retire thoroughbred racehorses. Judy has earned an international reputation in the field of physically integrated dance, and among other past honors, she will be receiving the Isadora Duncan Dance Award for sustained achievement in 2014. Welcome, Judy.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Dance artist Linda Johnson has been working throughout the West Coast as a choreographer, performer, arts administrator, and educator for over 25 years, and includes a visiting professorship in the dance department at Mills College from 2009-11 among her CV. She is a custodian of Yvonne Rainer's seminal postmodern work, Trio A, which will be featured for these performances and which we'll talk about shortly. She's also a teacher of the Alexander Technique. Linda, welcome.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Judy, I'd like you to first give our listeners an Axis 101 talk for people that don't know the good work that Axis does.
Well, we started in 1987, and we are based in Oakland, and we're a contemporary dance company doing physically integrated work, meaning we have dancers with and without physical disabilities. And in addition to commissioning works from really, really well-known choreographers and composers from around the country and even internationally, we also do a lot of touring, and we have a really strong education program, and that's probably about 40 to 50% of what we do, depending on the year and how much touring. And through that program, we perform for about 16 to 18,000 kids a year, both in schools and in theaters. So we do a lot of education from the kindergarten level up through the university level.
How do you find dancers for the company?
Well, that's tricky. It's a lot easier to find non-disabled dancers, though, you know, they have to be a particular kind of dancer that is really interested in thinking outside the box of dance. They have to have strong technique, be really strong improvisers. A lot of our dancers also choreograph works for the company because I like to support our in-house choreographers. Finding disabled dancers is trickier because we're at a level now where it really helps to have trained disabled dancers, and training does not really exist for disabled dancers. So that's part of why we started our education program, you know, 26 years ago, really almost right away. And a lot of our disabled dancers come through our education work, especially our summer intensive, which is part of our pre-professional training program. And then we also do an apprenticeship. We try to do one once a year. We won't have one this year, but next year we are hoping to have one or two disabled dancer apprentices. They've come to us from all over the world, actually.
Now, I mentioned in the intro that you've been in a wheelchair since an accident at age 17. Were you involved with dance before the accident?
No, I still don't know how I got here. I just happened to have the good sense to move from Colorado after five winters in a wheelchair.
Oh, my.
At 8,600 feet, I moved to Berkeley, and I met a woman and started doing improvisational movement, and it was just so wonderful to be physical again and to be doing something with my body, and that led me to martial arts, where I met our first artistic director, Thais Mazur, who actually had the idea to start AXIS. And she asked me if I wanted to be in a dance piece, and I was naive enough to say yes. And, you know, we all got together to do one piece for the revolutionary... No, that was actually Furious Feet Dance Festival for Social Change that the Dance Brigade used to do. And we just got hooked on what we were doing. It was, you know, something we didn't know anyone else was setting choreography. We knew that there was a lot happening in contact improvisation for people with and without disabilities, but we just got hooked on what we were doing, and I was so excited to be doing something really different. And I just kept going with it.
That's terrific. Now, AXIS is spelled A, like all in capitals, AXIS. I'm wondering what that stands for. Does it have a, is it an acronym or is it just?
Well, it is. It's not an acronym, though. About 3 months in, we realized it sounds a lot like ACCESS, which has been kind of a little bit of a curse. Because people go to look us up and they look up AXIS Dance Company and they won't find us. But, you know, we needed to have a name for our company, and we wanted to have something that represented who we were and the fact that there was something a little bit different about us, but we didn't really want to be literal. So the axis is also the center point of a wheel. We have this whole little spiel that we do for kids around AXIS and ACCESS. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talk about the spokes being all of the people that come together to make AXIS happen.
Mm, very nice analogy.
Yeah,
super. Linda,
yes.
Speaking again as a modest dance aficionado, in other words, dance ignoramus on this end of the microphone, could you tell us what was so special about the style of dance that Yvonne Rainer introduced in the mid-60s?
Well, Yvonne was part of what turned out to be a seminal collective of artists that have shaped the future of dance as we know it since 1962. Trisha Brown, Steve Paxton, David Gordon, Simone Forte. They were part of a group of artists that gathered in New York in the early 60s. Some were part of the Judson Dance Theater, some not. But they basically deepened the rebellion that modern dance began against ballet in the early 1920s and asked some very important questions about what dance was at its core. Who can be a dancer? What can a dance look like? What movement can be included in a dance? And they challenged the assumptions that were going on, again, in the ballet world, but even more deeply in the modern dance world, which would include Merce Cunningham's work, Graham's work, the sort of early, the modernists that were functioning at the time. And they sort of dismantled any of the assumptions and challenged them at that time. And this work, Trio A, which AXIS is performing, is considered to be the seminal work of that period. While there were many amazing works created during that time, this one has remained partly because there was a film made of it, so we can look back and actually see something from that period. And that was really the period of continued still photography, very little video from that period. So many of those dances are lost and only remain through photography. And also because it did encompass many of the ideas of all the peers working at the time, even though this single work is often held up as exemplary or as a marker of that period of time. So when one sees this dance, they see an entirely different use of the body. They see a different relationship with the use of energy, with the quality of attack, with the use of gaze, with a sense of continuity in how the movement is delivered. And even today, even though the dance is, you know, almost 50 years old, it's still very, very startling for either the very experienced dance goer or for the actual new initiate. And it's equally as startling for the trained dancer to try to learn. This is actually a historic moment that this piece is being performed by anyone other than an able-bodied dancer. So what AXIS is doing is actually quite historic. Yvonne has never released the work before to be translated by any thing, any dancer other than someone who can use all limbs as we expect. So she's given me great agency to translate and to adapt the work for the two dancers in Access. So it was very experimental. And it was a very interesting process. I had to teach all four of the dancers, two able-bodied and two in chairs, the work. And then they came up, each of the gentlemen in chairs came up with the options that they felt they could handle in interpreting what I had just shown. And then my work was to set about choosing which of the sometimes seven or eight options that they came up with mm-hmm. most accurately embodied the ideas that Yvonne was working at the time. Now, you see, that's still my interpretation of what's the priority in this little piece of court, this 30 seconds I've just taught, really trying to feel like, okay, was Yvonne foregrounding the spatial pattern? Was she foregrounding limbs? Was she foregrounding, what was she doing? And then choosing the version from the choices that the gentleman gave me that most represented that. So it was very collaborative in many, many ways. And in the end, I had to make the final decision. Although Yvonne, every time I leave, I send her the videos, and she actually either vets or refutes my choices.
That's Linda Johnson, who has adapted, along with Judy Smith, the work Trio A, which is part of the Axis Dance Company's home season at the Malanga Casklord Center for the Arts this coming weekend. And Linda, how did you get to become custodian of this seminal work?
Well, I'm one of five custodians whose job it is to teach and perform this work in perpetuity. And I became a custodian in 2000 after a long tutelage with the first custodian of Trio A named Pat Catterson, who learned it from Yvonne. I first learned and got permission to perform it, and I became so interested in it that I pursued having the rights to teach it. So I encountered Trio A in 1998 at the Robert Rauschenberg retrospective in New York, having never encountered it in my dance education. And I realized I didn't really know how to look at it, and I needed to understand it if I was going to keep going in the field. So I pursued learning it and then having a custodianship of it. So
And is that through the permission of Yvonne?
Oh, yes. I'm in
communication
very
with her.
Yes. So I had to go through a long tutelage with her. And in that process, it's not only learning the movement, but there's a lot of anecdotes and stories that go along. I mean, dance is really an oral tradition. It's really been passed folklorically until the past 30 or 40 years when we've had video. Before that, it was one prima ballerina teaching it to the next generation. And, you know, in the history of or in the lineage of Balanchine and Jerome Robbins, they really started that process in the United States. To learn one of those ballets, you really have to get permission from the foundation, and then a very specific dancer who was given permission by Balanchine comes out, makes sure the company can do it, and then teaches that dance only, whichever one Balanchine designated had permission. So artists of Yvonne's generation, like Cunningham, like Paul Taylor, Graham went through a very messy process with that, people will recall, about 15 years ago, are starting to identify which works go forward and which dancers are responsible for teaching them. So, yes, it was a very long tutelage with Yvonne.
That's a fascinating story of dance that I have no knowledge of. Thank you for sharing
that. Yeah, you're very welcome.
Judy, I'm wondering what your familiarity was with Trio A. Had you ever seen the work performed?
I had. I'd actually met Yvonne, and I'd known about her work. I'd known about Trio A, and then Mills College did a teach-in for Trio A, and then Yvonne did a video lecture and a presentation, and that was in 2010. And I went and saw that, and I was watching the piece and thinking, wow, this could be really, really interesting. And I wanted to restage an iconic work. Anyway, so I got very interested in Trio A, and I just felt like, looking at it, I knew that it would be an incredible challenge, but I felt like the essence of the work and the ideas of the work were very translatable, and I tend to use the word translate rather than adapt. We brought Linda down to do a teach-in, and it was an inclusive teach-in, so we had different disabled dancers in our company and then from the community at Mills learning it. And at the end of the day, I said, Linda, is this really going to work? And she was just really resounding yes.
Linda Johnson, you mentioned that you're getting feedback from Yvonne on this work. I'm wondering what kind of feedback, what that takes shape. What's she telling you?
Well, Yvonne is very excited by what she's seeing. I think that my sense is that she had some doubts, maybe some concerns or fears about releasing the work in this way for the first time. But originally, when we asked for permission for Access to learn this, she said, well, you know, it can't be called Trio A, kind of already creating a distance that this isn't, won't be what it really is. And so when I sent her the first footage, she wrote me back within, I don't know, a couple of hours, really quite excited. And one of the elements in the work that is very fundamental to it is this sort of task-like approach to performing the movement. So one of the things I think she observed is that when the gentlemen are negotiating their chair, which is very task-like, to move the chair around, to get it to spin, to get it to lift, they're involved in actual tasks. They're not performing tasks. They're doing the task. And they're doing that while they're performing the translated movement. And the synthesis of those two qualities, I think she saw, actually got closer to the essential nature of the work than she has ever seen an able-bodied dancer do. Hmm. And so she was very, very excited.
You mentioned that the chairs are part of the choreography as well. Judy, I'm wondering if you can address what is involved. Is there more upper body involved? And how are you involving the chair as part of your body?
I always consider my wheelchair to be kind of an extension of my body. Some dancers do, some people don't. But, you know, you really have to learn to integrate how the chair moves into whatever the choreography that you're doing is calling for. And, you know, there obviously a lot of the gesture comes from the upper body. But, you know, I do want to say that we're not a wheelchair dance company or a disabled dance company. And we often have dancers who, you know, use crutches or have prosthetics and dance with or without. And I also want to give our non-disabled dancers a ton of credit because we can't do what we do without both non-disabled dancers and disabled dancers. And they're equally important and they don't get highlighted as much as the disabled dancers, I think, because, you know, disabled dancers are still kind of a novelty. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that what they have to learn in order to work with this company is, you know, basically how to partner with a moving apparatus that's metal, has sharp edges, has wheels that, you know, can run over fingers and toes. And, you know, so, and they're all highly, highly skilled dancers, you know, that have been training all their lives to do this.
Can you share with us what else is on this program for the 2014 home season?
Yeah, I'm actually really excited about it. We have a guest artistic director here for 4 months, Mark Brew, who was a ballet dancer, and he was injured on tour in a car accident and uses a wheelchair. He's dancing in Trio A. And he's here because I have to be in the office. We're going through a lot of administrative growth and change, and I knew I just couldn't handle that and be in the studio. So he's making his second work for us. His first work, Full of Words, has been just a hit all over the country that we've toured it. And he's making a trio, and he'll also be performing a solo that he's been doing for a number of years. And then we're premiering our first dance for camera, The Gift of Impermanence, choreographed by Alex Ketley, who's we've worked with now for many years. And, you know, he's a dear friend and just an astounding choreographer. And so we're very excited to finally have a dance on camera. It's been a long time coming.
That's Judy Smith. She's artistic director and co-founder of Access, joined today by Linda K. Johnson, involved with this weekend's Access Dance Company, presenting Trio A and other works on Friday at 8, Saturday at 8, and Sunday at 2 p.m. at the Malonga Cask Lord Center for the Arts in Oakland. Information at the Access Dance Company website, www.axisdance.org, and tickets through axisdance.brownpapertickets.com. Boy, Judy, Linda, I thank you so much for taking some time to talk to us today.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Still to come this hour, Martin Segelka shares details about the San Francisco Wind Ensemble's performances this weekend. Peter Robinson gives us a preview of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in remembrance of Peter Matheson. and more live music from the Mobius Guitar Trio. They're part of an 8-hour lineup of music that is happening Saturday from 2 to 10 p.m. as part of the 7th Annual Switchboard Music Festival. Annie Phillips, one of the co-directors of the festival, joins me in studio now to talk about the festival. A clarinetist and bass clarinetist herself, she was formerly with the publicity department of the San Francisco Symphony and now teaches the business of music at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music and is an administrator of Zoo Labs, a music incubator in Oakland. Welcome, Annie.
Hello. How are you?
Nice to see you.
Thank you.
So, 7th Annual Marathon of Music, the Switchboard Music Festival, what was the inspiration for number one?
Well, number one was founded by Ryan Brown, Jeff Anderley, and Jonathan Russell while they were students at the conservatory, and they noticed this upwelling of young ensembles making, you know, classical-ish music or jazz-ish music that sort of didn't really fall into any particular genre. So they put together the first festival to be sort of a home for that kind of music making. And the first festival was in 2008, and this is our 7th. And we've had all kinds of artists play in the past. We've had Zoe Keating. We've had lots of other young conservatory ensembles. And then this year we have the Kronos Quartet headlining for us. And they sort of were the first group to do all this sort of genre-bending crossover music, so it's really great to have them.
And then we're going to be treated by two world premieres by the Kronos Quartet that'll finish out the festival, the marathon, right?
Yes, so we have a world premiere from Ryan Brown, who is one of the Switchboard co-directors, and then we also have one from Saba Amanikia, who is an Iranian composer who went to school with us at the conservatory, so a new work by him as well.
There's quite a roster of cats to herd for this festival. I imagine it's been a challenge, headlined by the Kronos, the two world premieres in the works. Let's talk about the lineup earlier in the day.
Okay. So we have 13 groups total performing across the 8 hours. We have the Mobius Trio who are here with us today. We have a group that I assembled called the Operators, that is sort of a super group that's coming together for the one day to play a piece by Greg Saunier, who's the drummer of Deerhoof. So he wrote this piece called the Deerhoof Chamber Variations, and there are 9 of us who are going to play that. We have Gamelan X, who are a contemporary gamelan ensemble, so they play like funk music on the Indonesian gamelans. We have Splinter Reeds, who are the Bay Area's first reed quintet, so they're clarinet, bass clarinet, oboe, bassoon, and saxophone.
Wow, neat.
And they're like a totally all-star group with Jeff Anderley, one of the other festival co-directors, and they're going to be playing a piece that's going to be narrated by David Harrington.
Oh, nice, nice.
Yeah, so that'll be really good. We have Make Under, which is an experimental indie pop band out of Oakland, headed up by my friend Hamilton Ulmer. And we have Blarvuster, which is a group that is led by Matthew Welch, who is a virtuoso bagpipe player. We have Jordan Glenn and Michael Coleman, who are two sort of local experimental music guys, and they'll be doing music for keyboard and percussion. They made like a little suite of songs that they'll be playing. Mm-hmm. Kate Campbell, the pianist, is going to be playing a piece by Julia Wolf from Bang on a Can, so a piece called My Lips from Speaking. She'll be doing the version for pre-recorded track and live piano. And then we also have the School of the Arts Orchestra. They'll be playing a piece by Anna Klein, who's one of the Chicago Symphony composers in residence. And we also have Odessa Chen in the Invisible Stories Ensemble. So she's a singer-songwriter who makes these like really intimate, beautiful little songs backed by a sort of chamber orchestra group. And then we have Grex, who are kind of our loud, experimental, like prog rock group who are going to be playing. And right before Kronos, we have Dublin, who is a vaudeville-style rapper. So he's a rapper. He fronts the Shotgun Wedding Quintet, which is the group that plays around. And he'll be performing and rapping, and it's sort of like vaudeville bluegrassy style music backing him up. And then we have Kronos at 9 p.m. as our headliner.
Wow. From 2 to 10 p.m., something for everyone. No exaggeration there. And it's all taking place at the Brava Theater.
Yep.
In the Mission.
Mm-hmm.
Information about the full festival at switchboardmusic.com, where you'll read more about the roster and more about all of the musicians involved. One of those ensembles is the Mobius Trio. They were described by the eminent Sergio Assad as the most inventive and exciting young guitar ensemble today. They exclusively perform music that they have commissioned, including works by Samuel Adams, which we'll hear shortly, Adrian Knight, and Belinda Reynolds, among others. A terrific trio. They are Robert Nance, Mason Fish, and Matthew Holmes Linder. Robert Nance of the Trio joins me now in studio to talk a little bit about the Mobius Trio. Hey, Robert.
How's it going?
Good, thanks. So how did Mobius get started?
Mobius got started through Matt Mason and I having done our master's programs at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. After our first year there, during that summer, we definitely would, you know, occasionally have the go out and grab a beer. And by that, I mean like three,
several,
four or five times a week. And then, you know, it was basically during that time that we all kind of expressed how fed up we were with, you know, playing traditional guitar music and playing solo guitar music. And so the three of us, you know, kind of
so,
all...
So no Paco Bell cannons in this group, right? No.
Not unless it's like, you know,
feedback.
Super processed and feedback. Yeah, exactly.
It could go that way, right?
So, yeah, that's how we kind of got started, just kind of a mutual love of playing new contemporary chamber music together.
So how did you come into the radar of Sam Adams?
Sam had written for a very good friend of ours, or two very good friends of ours, Travis Andrews and Andy Meyerson of the Living Earth Show, who are a phenomenal percussion and guitar duet. And, you know, they got in touch with Sam, and we're playing a couple of Sam's pieces, and then Sam got in touch with us, and we kind of formed a bond there. And for now, actually, Sam lives like a 5-minute walk from me in Oakland, so
nice.
He and I hang out a lot.
Cool.
So
and we're gonna hear a piece that he wrote for you called "Study for Mobius."
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about this piece.
So this piece is written for three guitars, but it's kind of cool because it's actually the same part played as a canon, speaking of canons. And it's funny because Sam, who will admit is not the most experienced guitar player, was commenting on how this is actually one of the hardest pieces that he's ever had to write, trying to write for three guitars. So, and he just showed me some sketches of some of the pieces that he didn't like so much for us. But this piece, it turned out to be fantastic, and we really, really enjoy playing it.
Neat. Well, we'll hear it now. It's Study for Mobius by Sam Adams, performed by the Mobius Guitar Trio, and then more with Annie Phillips, one of the co-directors of the Switchboard Music Festival.
Thank you.
Music of Sam Adams, Study for Mobius, performed by the Mobius Guitar Trio, who are Robert Nance, Mason Fish, and Matthew Holmes Linder. They're part of the Switchboard Music Festival from 2 to 10 p.m. this weekend at the Brava Theater, Saturday at the Brava Theater. They're part of that lineup. Annie Phillips back with me just to speak a little bit more about the festival. That's quite a performance we're going to get on Saturday from those guys.
Yes, it is.
So information about the festival is at switchboardmusic.com. I understand that the Switchboard is also presenting some things at the New Music Center on Taylor Street. Could you tell us just a little bit about that series?
Yeah, so this year we started a monthly concert series. So the festival is our flagship event that's happened for the past 6 years. This is the seventh, and this year, starting in February, we have a monthly concert series that is split bills from Switchboard, past festival artists, current festival artists, and other Switchboardian acts. So the first one, we actually had the Living Earth Show, Mobius Trio, and the Friction Quartet played. We had another one this month with the Americana Orchestra and Carl Cronin, and a band called Wild Hen, which my friend Crystal Pescucci headed up, and they're out of Mills College. So every month we have two or three acts, and they split a concert, and Lagunita sponsored it. So it's we all go, we hear a little music, we drink a little beer, we hear a little more music.
Sounds like my kind of concert.
Yeah, it's definitely really fun, and it's at the Center for New Music, which is a great new venue and a great, you know,
right on Taylor Street. And I guess all the information, not only about tomorrow's festival, but this series, is at switchboardmusic.com.
Yep.
Speaking of music of Sam Adams, we're going to be hearing shortly some music of Adams the Elder, Sam's dad, John, when I talk with Martin Segalcla of the San Francisco Wind Ensemble. Annie, thanks for taking some time to talk with us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
That's the sound of the San Francisco Wind Ensemble, one of the very few professional-level wind ensembles on the West Coast, being led by Dr. Martin Segalcla from their concert a year ago. It's a pleasure to welcome Martin back here to Open Air to talk about this upcoming concert of theirs. They're presenting this Saturday at San Francisco State, where Martin is a member of the music faculty at the School of Music and Dance. He's also a member of the conducting faculty at the Performing Arts Institute at Wyoming Seminary and the SUNY Fredonia Summer Music Festival. And a fairly recent news flash, Dr. Segalcla has accepted a position as director of bands at Illinois State University beginning this fall. A strong advocate of contemporary music, Dr. Segalcla has commissioned and premiered a large number of new works for Wind Ensemble. This concert at Knuth Hall this Saturday will feature works by David Maslanka, John Adams, and Boris Kozhevnikov. Martin, welcome back to KALW.
Very good morning. Oh, no, shoot.
Well, it's still morning as we're talking. That's true.
Okay, great. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Of course. A mouthful of composers involved in this concert. How did you first come across the music of Boris Kozhevnikov?
It was actually particularly through this piece that I first heard at a WASBE conference. WASBE is the World Association of Symphonic Bands and Ensembles, and it was a Japanese group, oddly enough, that presented Russian music at an international wind music conference. So it was a truly international event, and I was thrilled to hear this music. I had never come across it before. And then it was actually a year ago that I was reminded of this beautiful composition.
The work is his Symphony No. 3?
Yes, it's Symphony No. 3 by Boris Kozhevnikov.
For winds.
Specifically composed just for winds, no strings attached. And I was reminded by my dear friend and colleague, Larry Stoffel, who is teaching down at CSU Northridge, actually, who brought his wonderful, wonderful wind ensemble to San Francisco on his way up to Reno, where the CBDNA, that's the College Band Directors National Association conference, was happening about 2 years ago, actually. And on the way up there, he stopped at San Francisco State. We shared the stage for a combined concert with the SF State Wind Ensemble and his wonderful group. And he performed this piece. And I thought, well, that's actually wonderful. I'm very, very glad he brought this piece back to my attention. And it's about time that I start doing something with it, and here we perform it.
Well, what do you know about this guy, Boris Korzhebnikov?
He's a Russian composer. He's actually very, very famous in his home country, and a lot of Russian military ensembles are actually playing this piece all over, and it's a shame that nobody over here really knows this piece much or does much with it, because I think it's a beautiful contribution to our repertoire, and that's one of the reasons why we said, well, it needs a broader audience, so here we go, San Francisco Wind Ensemble. That's part of our mission, and here we should present it.
Well, all right. Well, let's give our audience a little sampling of the Symphony No. 3 of Boris Korzhebnikov that will be heard this coming Saturday by the San Francisco Wind Ensemble. Here is a taste of the charming third movement of Boris Korzhebnikov's Symphony No. 3. And then more with Martin Zagelka. That's delightful stuff there. The U.S. Marine Band performing there. You'll hear the San Francisco Wind Ensemble perform that, as well as the other movements of Mr. Korzhebnikov's Symphony No. 3. It kind of runs the whole gamut of Russian sounds that we heard the Shostakovich overture to start things off. It has those kinds of sounds. It has some Sturm und Drang, but also such tremendous charm.
Absolutely, yeah. The second movement is this really delightful waltz that, you know, Tchaikovsky couldn't have done it better in the Nutcracker. So it's very tonal. It's very, very neo-romantic in style. It's gorgeous music. We're very, very excited to be able to play it.
And I'm going to let you pronounce the subtitle of the Symphony No. 3.
Slavyanskaya.
Thank you very much for doing that.
You're welcome, anytime.
So how is the personnel formed for the San Francisco Wind Ensemble?
The personnel, or the ensemble, consists of all professional musicians in the Bay Area. They're fantastic, fantastic individuals. Let's keep in mind, they're professional musicians who have very important jobs during the daytime, and out of the goodness of their heart, they convene. Nobody's being paid to be part of this ensemble. They convene, and we get together on a Friday evening for rehearsal, Saturday afternoon dress rehearsal, Saturday night concert. Then we, you know, have a little bit break, and then come back together 6-8 weeks later for the next performance, and do the same spiel Friday evening rehearsal, Saturday afternoon dress, and Saturday night concert again.
Wow.
All new repertoire.
It's really significant repertoire, too. More power to you. But my gosh. So also on the program, works by David Maslanka, his In Memoriam. You also had Maslanka's music on your November concert. What's drawing you to keep coming back to David Maslanka?
I believe he is one of the most prominent American voices that we currently have for wind ensemble. He takes the medium to that next level. And when we look at the history of wind ensemble and its development, we're looking at a very short history, as you're well aware. I mean, the first pioneers really writing for this type of instrumentation, the pioneers came about at Gustav Holst's time, when we're talking in the early 1900s, when, you know, he wrote his suites, when Ralph Vaughan Williams composed his suites, and Granger started writing for it and really started to take this medium serious. And then we had this middle ground, this middle generation in the 1950s through 70s, where people like Vincent Persichetti and Schumann and Karl Husa started writing for this medium and started to really experiment in their own directions, started to have conversations amongst themselves about what should be an ideal instrumentation. Should we have 3 or 4 alto clarinets to balance the other 30 clarinets that they had at that time? And as you're well aware, then when Fred Fennell came about and the wind ensemble with the one player per part approach was coined and further developed, that's when people then in the 80s like Joseph Schwantner started to write specifically for one player per part wind ensembles and so on. So it's all very recent in its development, and David Mislanka is one of the most recent additions to this pool of really significant composers who are not writing down to the wind ensemble medium, who are not necessarily writing educational music or music of in a military tradition or something like that, who just say, I'm writing music and I'm simply using this particular medium to create this particular gamut of sounds. And I think he has a very unique voice, a very beautiful voice. What he does particularly in almost every composition that he writes, and very strongly so in his In Memoriam that we're going to be performing this Saturday, is his use of Bach chorales, J.S. Bach chorales. And you will hear a very prominent feature there this Saturday.
That's Dr. Martin Sagelka. He's conducting the San Francisco Wind Ensemble this Saturday at Knuth Hall at San Francisco State. It's a free concert at 7:30. Music by David Mislanka, by Boris Kozhevnikov, as well as by John Adams, which we'll hear shortly. I understand that in addition to this coming Saturday's concert, you've got an exciting recording project coming up. Tell us about that.
Yes, indeed. We were very, very honored and extremely fortunate to have been invited to Skywalker Studios by Phil Perry, who is a sound recording engineer and producer. And it is a very unique collaboration, actually, with Oman, where he and his team is actually, they're training sound recording engineers over there, and they're doing some recording projects down there. But it's a mutual collaboration. So actually for this particular project, some recording engineers from Oman will actually join us here at Skywalker Ranch for the whole recording process, and they will collaborate with the team here on just this really cool international collaboration. And we were very fortunate. They asked us, do you want to participate? So here we are. We are going to be recording our first album professionally at Skywalker Ranch, one of the most fascinating studios in the world.
Wow, win-win situation all the way around.
Absolutely. We're extremely excited and very honored.
I want to congratulate you on your new position in Illinois, Martin.
Thank you.
We're certainly going to miss your talents guiding the young people of San Francisco State, but I understand you'll be back to conduct the San Francisco Wind Ensemble for their upcoming concerts.
Absolutely, yes. I will continue this post. I look forward to being back here in the Bay Area at least four times a year for our productions.
Fantastic. So also on this program is John Adams' Lollapalooza. Now, is that a work originally written for band?
Yes.
Wind Ensemble, or tell me.
Well, I should actually say no. The original was composed for symphony orchestra. This is a transcription, and I think the piece was most prominently featured, actually, by Simon Rattle, who was a big proponent of the piece, performed it all over Europe, actually, brought the American sounds over there, and performed them both in Great Britain and Germany very prominently. And I think this transcription is actually very successful because the main features off the piece are actually in the wind parts of the original too. For instance, the Lollapalooza rhythm, which gave the piece its slightly odd title, is prominently featured in the trombones, and then spreads through that whole brass section, and then all over the all over the wind parts in the original. And so the string players in the Bay Area may forgive me in saying that I think the prominent features are definitely preserved, and that the piece does very well in this wind transcription. Otherwise, somebody as critical in many musical terms as John Adams would probably not even have authorized the transcription in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll hear a little bit of that now, but let me say best of luck to you for this upcoming concert. Information about the San Francisco Wind Ensemble's Saturday concert is at sfwindensemble.org. Martin, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it. We'll be right back.
touch of Sam Adams' Lollapalooza, to be heard by the San Francisco John Adams' Lollapalooza. The Adams family, that's all together. John Adams' Lollapalooza, to be heard by the San Francisco Wind Ensemble this weekend.
Brush up your Shakespeare. Stop quoting him now. Brush up your Shakespeare, and the women you will bow.
Just declaim a few lines from Othello, and she'll think you're a hell of a fella.
If your blonde won't respond when you flatter her, tell her what Tony told Cleopatra.
If she fights when her clothes you are mussing,
what a clothes much ado about nothing. Brush up your Shakespeare, and they're all out.
Here to brush up our Shakespeare is Peter Robinson with a preview of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and a remembrance of the bard on his birthday. Hi, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to be here. Yeah, and it is. It's 450 years next Wednesday, April the 23rd.
And I didn't send a card. Jeez.
Oh, he's still waiting for it. To be or not to be, or to post or not to post. But I actually think with the to be or not to be, Hamlet was trying to choose a pencil, but then you had to remember the days of the old pencils, to be or not to be.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
So if you do travel north for the season, it has now opened in Ashland, Oregon, and it is a great journey up. It's about a six-hour drive from San Francisco. You head through Redding, and I always warn people that Smokey the Bear hangs out in that long strip hiding behind the trees, so don't get a ticket as you hit the quaint, beautiful little boutique town of Ashland in southern Oregon. Now, this year, the Shakespeare plays really do bring together history, philosophy, tragedy, and comedy. And the one which runs throughout the season is The Tempest. In fact, I was thinking early on as we heard that music from that ensemble, one of the key characters in The Tempest is Ariel, who is a spirit who flies around in the sky, often on a piece of wire. And the alternative to Ariel is Caliban. And I was thinking, as musical contrast, you've got the deep earth with Caliban, you've got the aerial spirit flying high, and I think that type of music might be something that the director would really consider. Now, I mentioned all categories there, tragedy, history, philosophy. The Comedy of Errors is the comedy section, and the tragedy, of course, is the great Richard III, the winter of our discontent or the summer of our, indeed, high content. Now, there are three theatres when you go up to Ashland, and it's worth checking to make sure which of those three theatres the particular play that you want to see is appearing in. So let me say a little bit about the theatres up there. The Angus Bowman is the classic theatre. That certainly is one of the ones which has been there longest. The Elizabethan Stage is a semi-outdoor theatre, and that is, in fact, where the Richard III will be performed. And then they have a new theatre, which is a development. It's called the Thomas Theatre, which is much more open space, a kind of horseshoe-type shape. And that is where the Comedy of Errors, which is directed by Kent Gash. The other thing about Ashland is they do call it the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, but in fact there are at least three contemporary or revival plays which aren't connected with Shakespeare, and they are worth going to. And one that I would highlight at the moment, which is currently running, in fact it started in February and it runs through until November the 3rd, is called The Coconuts. It's music by Irving Berlin and the book by George S. Kaufman. So you have an interesting contrast if you want to blend Shakespeare with contemporary theatre, or in this case, 1920s semi-musical type theatre.
How long have you been going up to the festival, Peter?
I first went, believe it or not, in 1968. I was actually teaching at Lewis and Clark, which is in Portland, Oregon.
I was actually 5 years old.
Oh. Well, there we are. Age and wisdom, they sometimes come to early people in early youth. So that was how that was. But for the radio station and also for the newspapers, in the last 25 years, I've made an annual pilgrimage. Just talking about Bay Area Shakespeare, because in fact, we too have our own stack of festivals.
Before we segue to that, just for information for the full Oregon Shakespeare Festival, go to osfashland.org.
Yeah, that is the good website, and they'll give you breakdowns because these plays run throughout a season and there are different dates for different plays. But in fact, in the Bay Area, you can go from Santa Cruz to Marin County. You have Shakespeare in Santa Cruz. You have the Marin Shakespeare at the Dominican University. And then in the East Bay, we have Cowshakes. And last week, I was speaking to the dramaturge, Philippa Kelly. One of the Cowshakes is Pygmalion. So, again, you've got an interesting blend of Shakespeare and, in this case, George Bernard Shaw. So it's a good area for the bard to be reintroduced. And in fact, at the Verdi Club, which is here in Mariposa, on next Wednesday, they are having a Shakespeare cocktail party and dinner. The bard, of course, won't be there, but it is a fundraiser for Shakespeare in the Park.
And hopefully not the ghost of Hamlet either at the party. Well, that might be a nice touch.
Well, we could have Macbeth just to serve the wine with a hint of blood.
I'm sure we'll be having some more highlights of the Bay Area Shakespeare offerings on open air in the weeks and months ahead. I understand you also have a remembrance for us today, Peter.
I have got a remembrance, but just first, a play where I interviewed the director last week. It opens at the Maskers Theatre, which is a small theatre in Richmond. It's not frequently done. It's called The Old Lady Shows Her Medals. And in fact, it's by J.M. Barrie, who is better known for Peter Pan. He wrote this play in 1916. It was the height of the First World War. And it is a story really about a soldier coming back from the trenches, and it takes place as wives and a charlady discuss the whole nature of those terrible days shortly after the Battle of the Somme. Norman MacLeod is the director on this. It opens at the beginning of May. In fact, the dates it runs are from Friday, May the 2nd to May the 4th. It's only a short run. And it is at the Maskers Playhouse, which is 105 Park Place, Point Richmond. A delightful little theatre. And if you're going, I often suggest having dinner at the Mac, which is just opposite. So that's something local, opening in just a couple of weeks' time. I'd like to say, in a totally different context, just a few words about the sad death of Peter Matheson. He died on Sunday, and I did interview him in 2008 in London when he was in England. He, of course, is the author of The Snow Leopard, probably one of the most kind of spiritual journey-type books. He has one of the few distinguished classic prizes, the National Book Prize, for both non-fiction and for fiction. Of course, he was one of the founding members of the Paris Review, one of the most influential papers, both for author interviews, and little known, but it was discovered in more detail by Salon magazine, is that in the mid-50s, he actually worked for the CIA and used the Paris Review. People don't often put this in his obituary. He did only work there for 2 years. Now, one of my interests is his own late years in life when he was an officiate practitioner of Zen Buddhism. And I remember at the time he gave me a quote, which I've still down to today found extremely helpful. And he said that Zen is a reminder to stay alive and be awake. He went on, we tend to daydream, speculating about the future and dwelling on the past. Zen is about appreciating your life in this moment. So in this moment, a fond and bid farewell to Peter Matheson, and in this moment, I'm here at KLW, remembering, and it's good to be here, and a sad loss to anyone who enjoys both non-fiction and non-fiction written by the author of The Snow Leopard, Peter Matheson.
Thank you so much for that, Peter, and for your insights into Shakespeare. I'm sure we'll have you on to talk about some of the Bay Area offerings in the weeks ahead. I'm David Latulippe. You've been listening to Open Air, our weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. A reminder that a link to all of the events that we were discussing this hour are at our website, kalw.org, as well as the full audio from today's program and past shows as well. You can research past open-air shows at kalw.org. It's there where you can also send me some suggestions for some segments or guests that you'd like to hear on the air here. My thanks to Neil Swinkles, my co-producer, for helping run things here. And we'll see you again next week for another edition of Open Air. Thanks for listening.